Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokane7.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time law professor at Gonzaga University School of Law.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that features three movie fans who fit more or less their respective roles. Nathan is the film encyclopedia, Mary Pat is our legal expert, and I try my best to herd both these cool cats. The roles that people play is a theme that fits the three movies that we'll be discussing this week, particularly as to how that theme applies to an actor cast in each. We're talking about Marlee Matlin in Coda, John David Washington in Beckett, and Hugh Jackman in Reminiscence. Let's begin this show with a film, the title of which, Coda, is actually an acronym. It's not that movies about people with disabilities aren't being made. It's just that they aren't usually made with people who have genuine disabilities. It's been some 34 years since Marlee Matlin, who is deaf, won a Best Actress Oscar for the film Children of a Lesser God. Matlin is back in the film CODA, which is an acronym for Child of Deaf Adults. The child in question is Ruby, played by Emilia Jones, whose parents, Jackie, played by Matlin, and Frank, played by Troy Kotsur, not to mention older brother Leo, played by Daniel Durant, are all deaf, the characters and those latter three actors in real life. That fact gives Coda an added bit of reality to what otherwise might seem like your typical teen angst movie. Ruby, you see, is her fishing family's only real tie to the hearing world, and that obligation is getting in the way of her desire to forge her own path, which, ironically, involves singing. Through the help of a teacher, Ruby just might have a chance at a scholarship, unless money woes and the threat of a family business failure get in the way. Coda, which is a remake of the 2014 French film La Famille Bélier, isn't the most original movie, but it does have a few moments of genuine emotion, along with that acting authenticity.
Yeah, you may have heard of this movie, Coda, because it won all of the major dramatic awards at Sundance,
which
2021.
Which I find pretty amazing.
Yeah, well, and it was the opening film of Sundance, that's where I saw it. Yeah. And after it was over, I thought this will probably win the festival because it feels like such a warm-hearted film festival friendly movie. And of course it did. And then Apple set a record by picking this movie up for distribution for something like $25 million. It was the most money ever spent for a film out of Sundance. And then they just kind of dumped it onto their Apple Plus streaming service. I haven't seen much publicity around this movie, which you would think it would be all over the place if they spent that kind of money. Mm-hmm. But I do think this is a movie that is going to find an audience if that audience is aware the movie exists, because it is a crowd pleaser in all the ways you expect a movie like this to be. And my struggles with it were that the whole movie kind of feels like a tug of war between a really authentic, kind of scrappy, small-town drama and a really syrupy coming-of-age dramedy.
That's and right. I think afternoon it, special almost.
And I think it works better in that first mode. And there are moments, even moments that do kind of spill over into that syrupy territory, that manage to work for me emotionally. And I think it's because of the authenticity of the actors. There's a character that you didn't mention in your intro, played by Eugenio Derbez, who is the main character's music teacher and is the one that's encouraging her to follow her dreams of studying music at Berkeley. He's well known in Mexico for his kind of screwball farces that he's been in. A few of them have become hits over here. And he's playing that character like he's in a screwball farce, and it doesn't work.
Yeah, I didn't think so.
But about halfway through the movie, he gets to tone down a little bit and becomes a real human being. And again, the whole film, Coda, is sort of struggling between those two modes. Should this be sort of a family-friendly romp? Should it be a more earthbound or seabound, in a couple of cases, study of what it's like to be a deaf person in a hearing world, the struggles between the only hearing member of a family and the others? So there are some really strong, complex ideas running throughout this movie, but they're packaged in a really predictable way.
Mm-hmm.
However, I think the performances are enough to make this work, even in moments where I knew I was being manipulated. Oh man, that final performance, there's a moment, it's a musical audition that is so phony and yet somehow works. It kind of snuck up on me in a way because I was kind of rolling my eyes at certain moments in Coda. And then it kind of gets you. And I'm going to credit the actors, not just Emilia Jones, who I think is terrific in this movie, but also people like Marley Matlin. It was so good to see her in a movie again. And she's also really, really strong, as is Troy Kotsur as the dad.
Yeah, I thought he was great.
Yeah, they have a really good dynamic throughout the movie.
And the really nice thing about it is he's basically unknown to a mainstream audience.
Right, Troy Kotsur. And apparently some of this was improv. And as a matter of fact,
it feels like it.
Yeah. So Marley Matlin, I did see an interview with her, and she was saying that she could hardly stop cracking up because of some of the descriptions that he came up with sort of on the fly that were not in the script. And so I liked that about this movie. I was surprised it got so much acclaim at Sundance because it is derivative of these other foreign language films.
And I didn't even realize it was a remake when I saw it, but it makes sense.
Yeah. And so, as a matter of fact, if you look at the French film, they're cheesemakers. Dairy farmers. So that's intriguing. There was something about this, as you indicate, which is so touching, but then sort of so predictable at the same time. So you have all these characters and you can sort of figure out how they're going to maybe come together in these various ways and so forth. I also thought that maybe there were some missed opportunities to bring the audience to understand more clearly the sort of complications in the deaf community itself, because there is this whole notion of sort of people who are culturally deaf, and that's typically or oftentimes people who, you know, have been deaf from birth or from a very early age versus those who are sort of physically deaf who get some sort of hearing impairment later in life. And so they touched on some of these things, but I think they might have done an even better or more thorough job with bringing that to the fore.
I think the parts of the movie that deal with that the best are parts that we haven't discussed yet, which is the fact that this is set in a small fishing village and
Nantucket.
And the family here makes all of their money by catching fish. And yet all of these kind of mom and pop fishing operations are being run out by the commercial fishermen. And so I think it's one of the more interesting elements of the film. And I almost wish there had been more and less of the studying to get into Berkeley stuff.
Yeah.
Or the relationship that she has with the high school kid. It's the star of I don't have his name in front of me, but he was the star of that movie Sing Street. And, you know, there's some cutesy pie stuff going on there. But there are these discussions of like unionization and how can we effectively communicate that this is what we need in order to succeed. And then there's that extra barrier to entry because they have to communicate through sign language and their only interpreter is their daughter who's trying to forge her own way. There's a really good conflict there. And it's yet somehow it's not really the central conflict of the movie.
Right. And I think that your use of that term conflict is exactly the point, because there's no sense of danger in this movie. There's no real threat. There's no, oh, my God, something bad can happen.
You always know
here.
You're going to be safely
exactly.
delivered home
exactly.
at the end.
Which is what we were talking about, the feelings of this being an afternoon special. And I suppose that the movie works in the sense that we all kind of all still like the movie despite its detriments.
Well, I think it is, as we pointed out, it's the bond among the actors that mirrors the bond in the family. And then the point at which the daughter decides, as you point out, that she has to sort of go her own way. How is everybody going to deal with that? And I did think that they handled that well, because I think that anybody who's launched a child off to college or whatever, there's that last sort of senior year of push, pull and, you know, clutching on and moving forward at the same time and self-individuating and so forth. And so I thought they did a really good job with that. But some of the other aspects of it.
There's a scene in which a government investigator has to go out on the boat. And it's like she doesn't know that they're deaf. I mean, before she goes on and she discovers it and the Coast Guard gets involved and it's like, oh, please.
It's a manufactured conflict so that the protagonist can then struggle with her choices.
Right.
Because
which could have been done so much more easily.
It could have. And more organically. But I do think that is a realistic conflict for her to have, this idea that she wants to go off and do her own thing.
Oh, absolutely.
Her parents want her to go off and do her own thing, but she's worried that, well, what happens if they're left to their own devices because we don't have the money to pay somebody to be a professional translator for us? And so I think that works. And then the director, Sean Hader, keeps kind of intruding on her own story with these, you know, again, they feel like crowd-pleasing moments. And I can imagine, we've all been to film festivals where there are moments that seem almost designed for packed festival audiences to react to, and this movie is full of them.
Yeah.
And I mainly I'm thinking of that, I alluded to it earlier, that final performance, and it's of the Joni Mitchell song Both Sides Now. And I talked about that tug of war aspect earlier, and I was kind of experiencing it as I was watching that, because the actors sell the scene even though it is totally phony.
Yeah.
And it's just a weird back and forth that my brain was doing the entire time I was watching Coda.
Yeah, yeah. And that was Coda. This is Movies 101, and it's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcast of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to look at Beckett and Reminiscence. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
Visit Spokane Public Radio's website and find out what's happening with the online community calendar. Check out detailed event listings, search by region, or submit your own event by visiting SpokanePublicRadio.org. Click on the community calendar graphic on our homepage. Find something fun, inspirational, or educational to do, or share your own event with the region. Let's all support the arts and entertainment in our community.
And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I discussed Coda. Let's now move to Beckett and Reminiscence, and let's begin with an adventure into choice, chance, and circumstance. John David Washington needs a change of pace. In recent years, his film roles have been mega intense: an undercover cop in Spike Lee's Black Klansman, a time-warped investigator in Christopher Nolan's Tenet, and most recently as an American man on the run from Greek authorities in Fernandino Cito Filomarino's action study titled simply Beckett. Following a car accident with his girlfriend, played all too briefly by Alicia Vikander, our protagonist Beckett, played by Washington, suddenly finds himself hunted by the very police officers and other mysterious characters from whom he initially sought help. As he escapes from one situation to the next, making life difficult for a series of Greek citizens as he tries to work his way to the American embassy in Athens, Beckett slowly figures out what's going on, which at least some of us have already deduced. Despite the script's predictability, director Cito Filomarino does have a feel for continual action, and Washington proves again to be a charismatic performer. Maybe, though, he needs to lighten up just a tad. Maybe a romantic comedy, or better yet, a role in the next Will Ferrell farce?
Let me think about that for a moment. I think Beckett is one of those films that has some high points and some other points, as one of my colleagues once proclaimed about something that I wrote. At any rate, Beckett, I appreciated the fact that it was set in Greece, but not the Greece of Santorini that we're accustomed to seeing.
And or I think of Mamma Mia, which I'm accustomed to seeing.
Right. Yeah. And so I think that that's one of the criticisms that's been leveled at this film is like, where the heck is this taking place? But Greece is mountainous. It is, you know, deserty at various points
and so forth. We've driven through some of the very spots that this movie is filmed in.
So I appreciated that about the film. I also think that it did a good job early on of immersing us in this situation or scenario, and it gave you the feeling of what would happen if something went awry when you're in a country where you know no one, where you do not speak the language, where you cannot figure out who's on first and who you can trust and so forth. So I liked the scene-setting aspects of this film, but then it started to go kind of off track, in my opinion, because there are too many different kind of things for us to figure out, but not in a way that's super intriguing. And that's, I think, problematic for us as people who are watching this. It's not really a thriller completely. It's a political film. It's a film about making connections and trying to find your way. And it's a film about John David Washington running and running and more running.
And being shot at and running some more.
Right.
Yes.
And so I think it just never really found its center exactly. And it has gotten really panned by some legitimate critics. And I think maybe they're being a little bit too harsh on it because it did keep my interest throughout. The contrast between what's happening sort of in the rural area versus what's happening in downtown Athens, I thought they portrayed that well. And some of the cinematography I really appreciated. But yeah, I think overall this is kind of a miss.
Well, I tend to be more on the positive side of this, even though I also agree that Beckett is not exactly a good movie, at least by the standard definition. But I was also involved in it, even though there's very little dialogue, there's very little plot. It is mostly running. It's mostly about movement. The people that made this are collaborators of Luca Guadagnino, and so it kind of has that same sort of airy artsiness.
Call Me by My Name.
Yeah, that he tends to bring to his movies. And I agree with you that the cinematography is really good. But I sort of appreciated the leanness of this movie and just kind of the emotional remove of it because I mean, it begins with John David Washington and Alicia Vikander on vacation, and they're so happy, you know they're doomed. And I expected it to go in a predictable way, and it did keep me on my toes. I also like the fact that he bumbles a lot. He's an action hero, but he's also a regular guy.
He's like Joe Tech guy.
Having said that, there are moments where I thought, oh, come on. There's no way that he would be able to get out of this scrape. And I think that the more discombobulating it is, the better, because we figure out what's going on and it's not nearly as interesting as our imaginations would be. But I was reminded of something like Frantic, maybe, or Don't Look Now, this kind of Euro thrillers.
There's the point right there, and we'll get into this a little bit when we talk about reminiscence, but how many movies are this? Is this derivative of the Running Man movie?
And so it felt like something that maybe Steven Soderbergh would have made, kind of a meat and potatoes
and
sort of
probably
action.
Better.
Probably, yeah. But I think I liked this more than both of you.
Yeah, probably. And that was Beckett. Let's close with reminiscence. What is it with Hugh Jackman, someone who is that good-looking, that talented singer and dancer, and who has shown he has some acting skills, should be enjoying a far better career than he's had. But when your best role is, arguably, as a sideburned, cly-quit mutant named Wolverine, and not in a romantic comedy, straight drama, or even a musical such as The World's Greatest Showman, well, someone needs better representation. Jackman's latest bad decision is to star in a blend of sci-fi and neo-noir titled Reminiscence, which boasts almost as many cinematic cliches as it does stretches of ponderously structured dialogue. Jackman stars as Nick Bannister, a private eye working in a dystopian future whose specialty involves tracing memories and rewarding or punishing those he works on by allowing them to relive their most pleasant or horrific experiences. His life changes when the obligatory femme fatale, played by the English-speaking Swedish actress Rebecca Ferguson, comes into his life and then suddenly disappears, leaving him tortured and bent on figuring out what went wrong. None of it is believable, except maybe for the special effects that work at portraying a Miami flooded by rising oceans. Writer-director Lisa Joy, in her first feature film outing, should have paid attention to the late Heath Ledger's Joker. Why so serious? And Jackman, well, he should look for a new agent.
We talked about derivation with the previous two movies, but this is the most derivative by far. I mean, I can think of a dozen movies that this not only is reminiscent of, pun intended, but just completely cribs from. I mean, Blade Runner, Inception, Minority Report, Dark City, Chinatown,
Altered States,
every noir film ever made. And to the point where I thought maybe this is deliberate because it's a film about retreating into memories and nostalgia.
But it's not really an homage to any of those films.
I think it's just ripping off things that we know already. And I think that would be okay if there was a compelling story here or a compelling hero or even a compelling femme fatale. But this is just really lockstep everything you expect it's going to be. I didn't even think the special effects were that special. This movie is so drab and monochromatic. There are a few images here and there where I thought, oh, I can see where Lisa Joy wanted to go with this. And she's probably best known for co-creating Westworld.
Right.
And this has some of the same kind of high-tech ideas and themes of memory and perception. But
and it has
Thandie Newton.
Thandie Newton, yes.
Right. And that, to me, actually was the highlight of this film.
And she's given nothing to do.
Right. She has not given anything to do, but you can see her trying to make something happen. But it was great to see her again. Mm-hmm. And Rebecca Ferguson, I don't think that this was the proper vehicle to showcase her talents.
She's kind of become a Mark of bad movies. I
don't
hate
you
to
think?
Say
yeah,
it.
Like, that's
she had such a strong start in the Mission Impossible movies, like stealing scenes away from Tom Cruise.
But then she was in Rose the Hat in that Stephen King adaptation,
and she was in The Snowman. Remember
thing? Yeah,
like
yeah.
Now, when I see her in a movie, I think, oh, I hope this isn't. Yeah, she. Speaking of agents, like I think she needs a better agent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what to do with Hugh Jackman? I mean, because.
The movie Logan, I swear to God,
there
the man
go.
Was born to play this character, and he does it so well. It's you see just how good and how pained and angst that character is, but that's the best he can do? I mean, he can't do that. Has he not played Shakespeare or something? I mean, this guy is so he has such potential.
Going back to Reminiscence, which, by the way, is streaming on HBO Max.
As well as screening in the theaters.
So you can see it. And I would recommend you not spend money. If you've already paid for HBO Max, then go for it. I think that this is the kind of movie that the people making it tricked themselves into thinking had more weight and thematic resonance than it actually had. I can see them sitting on set going, oh, this is a symbol of...
There's not really nuance to it.
Oh,
I mean,
no,
it's
absolutely
you know, it's kind of in your face. Which and when you start piecing all the different plot lines together, you're like, meh.
Becomes kind of impossible to follow halfway through.
But like William Goldman wrote, you know, when it comes to making movies, nobody knows anything. I mean, you can imagine them sitting around on the original Blade Runner set and having the same conversations, and it worked there, even with the narration or without.
Yeah.
You know, you can argue that this. Take out the narration and there's no movie, but the narration is so ponderous, so mind-numbing.
And I was kind of waiting for this to be not a guilty pleasure of sorts, but sort of like a fun thrill ride. And
right.
It's just so leaden and poorly paced. And,
well,
yeah,
and as you point
this
out,
was given
dark.
Nothing. Yeah.
Dark.
Yeah. Yeah.
Dark. In terms of the way, the imagery.
Multiple ways.
Yes, exactly.
Good point.
And that was Reminiscence. And this is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster. And early in the show, Nathan Weinman, Murray Pat Truthart, and I discuss Coda and Beckett. Let's take this moment to thank Peter Glarberg for both producing and engineering the show, and we thank you to our loyal listeners. We invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again check out all the best that cinema has to offer wherever we can find it. Until then, remember these words from the late, great Katharine Hepburn. Acting is the most minor of gifts and not a very high-class way to earn a living. After all, Shirley Temple could do it at the age of 4. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.